punishing her sister, who was his major hold over her. But now she wanted something else, something much bigger. She wanted Astro Corporation for her own. That gave him a bigger, more powerful control of the beautiful redhead. Gaetano smiled to himself as he sat in his Paris office. Steepling his fingers, he leaned far back in his chair and gazed out his window at the gleaming white dome of Sacré-Cœur up on Montmartre's hill, and waited for the phone call he expected. So Kate wants her sister to join her on the moon. From the videos I've seen of her, she's a good-looking redhead, too. Skinny, almost scrawny, but that's from her drug addiction. Once she's on the moon, Kate will fill her out. Maybe I'll go up there, too, for a vacation, perhaps. Two redheads in the same bed are better than one. Sisters, too. That should be interesting. The phone chirped. Gaetano leaned forward in his chair, stretched out his arm, and picked up the handset. Yes, he said in English. A man's voice replied. I just heard that there has been an airplane crash in Texas. A friend of President Scanwell was killed. A man named Jeffrey Robertson. Ah, said Gaetano. Too bad. Make certain that President Scanwell receives the news. I believe she already has, said the voice. I see, Gaetano said. Thank you. As he put down the phone, he saw Jane Scanwell standing in his doorway, her face stricken with grief and hatred. 25. Dan was humming to himself as he stood at the controls of the hopper. It had been a good trip. He had carried a full load of pilfered electronic simulation equipment, erotic videotapes, and the homebrew liquor everyone called rocket juice, all the way out to the Fra Mauro complex, halfway to Copernicus. The construction team building the new mining and refining center there had paid handsomely. Not in cash, of course. In electronic credits, which Dan immediately relayed to Pops Tucker back at their shelter, and Tucker deposited in one of the safe banks they had picked. They had three, all Earthside, one on the Cayman Islands, one in Liechtenstein, and one in New Jerusalem. Each bank had a reputation for discretion, solidity, and compliant GEC inspectors. Tucker sent the credit information directly earthward by a small communications laser that George had assembled for them. They spoke directly to a specific commsat in Earth orbit, bypassing all lunar communications nets. Dan knew from his own early experiences that the most deadly hazard on the moon is boredom, especially in a new, raw camp without any real facilities for entertainment. A guy could do crazy things in his empty off-duty hours. He'd known men who just walked off in their pressure suits and never came back. More often, there'd be a fight over one of the women, or over one of the men. The fights could be brutal. Or worse still, they could create smoldering grudges that ended in outright murder. Rocket juice helped pass the idle hours, although it could also aggravate the tensions and confrontations. So did drugs. Dan thought that the simulation equipment would be the most help to the construction workers. There were enough electronics whizzes among them to jigger the equipment into virtual reality rigs, where a person could put on a simulator helmet and escape into a private fantasy world for hours on end. That's why the construction camp supervisors looked the other way when Dan landed with his load of goodies. They knew better than the administrators who worked in safe, comfortable offices back at Alphonsus that their crews needed diversion and entertainment almost as much as they needed oxygen and water. Dan Randolph, benefactor of the working man, he said to himself. And woman, he added, grinning. One of the construction workers had been especially grateful for his appearance, a rangy brunette with the kind of sculptured face he remembered from his years in Caracas. She had shown Dan to a private little shelter just large enough for two. It had been the best hour Dan had spent since Tet Yoroa. He grimaced inside his helmet at the memory of that tropical atoll, and Jane, and Malik, and how they had all conspired to strip him of everything he had built. I'll get it all back, he muttered to himself. I'll get it back if I have to tear down everything between here and Paris. His dark mood ended almost at once, though. because the beeper on his control panel began flashing its red light. The propellant tanks were sitting down there on the dusty, pockmarked Nubium plane, precisely where the Japanese guy he was dealing with at Yamagata had said he would leave them. Their mini-transponder was sending out its weak little signal. You had to be practically on top of the tanks before you would know they were there. Dan nudged his pistol-grip joystick forward, and the hopper descended, flat as a carpet, no nosing down as a plane would in Earth's atmosphere. It was night once again on this side of the moon. Dan only operated the hopper at night, less chance of being spotted by a legitimate vehicle or one of the satellites in orbit. He strained his eyes for sight of the tanks and finally saw them, sitting gray and round like a trio of natural boulders on the darker basaltic floor of the mare. It took the better part of an hour to refill the hopper's tanks. Dan almost forgot to disconnect the transponder beacon. At the last minute, he unclipped it, shut it off, and carried it back aboard the hopper. Then he took off again on the final leg of his trip back to the shelter, where George and Pops Tucker were waiting for him. Dan was bone-weary when he finally opened the inner hatch of the airlock and stepped into the shelter's familiar confines. Even before he could slide open his helmet visor, he realized that he had stepped into a trap. George and Tucker were nowhere in sight. Instead, there was a quartet of strangers in dark gray coveralls holding pistols leveled at him. "You're under arrest, Randolph," said one of the men. Dan recognized him as the burr-headed jock he had shot back in his office the first time they had tried to take him in. "And this time, you're not getting away." To her credit, Kate Williams did not gloat. In fact, she seemed more than serious. She seemed wrathful. "Drugs!" she nearly screamed at Dan. "You've been peddling drugs to my people here!" They had brought Dan to his former office, where Kate now stood behind his old desk, shaking with fury. "Recreational stuff," he said, taken back by her rage. "Nothing harmful." "How the hell would you know what's harmful and what isn't?" Kate snarled. "Did you try any of the junk yourself?" Dan blinked with surprise. Of course he hadn't. Alcohol was his drug of choice. "So you've turned into a dirty drug dealer," Kate snarled. "Look at you. You even smell filthy." "I've been in a spacesuit for damned near 14 hours, Dan said defensively. But he knew it was more than that. He hadn't cut his hair or beard in weeks. His coveralls were shabby and unwashed.
"The great Dan Randolph, a drug dealer, smuggler, thief. You're never going to get out of jail."
Dan just sat there, knowing that she was right. He felt utterly exhausted, spiritually as well as physically. There was only one way Kate could have found him, he thought. George or Pops must have turned him in, waited until I was out by myself and they ran to the authorities. Saved their own skins, probably. The sons of bitches will probably access the money we've banked. He felt totally alone in the world, alone in the universe, betrayed by everyone he had known, including this furious redhead standing behind his desk in his office. Anger surged through Dan. "You've stolen everything I've worked to build up," he said to her through gritted teeth. "You've got a fucking lot of nerve to call me a thief."
"You're the one who's broken the law," she snapped.
She turned slightly and said in a softer voice,
"I could see why you ran away, Dan. But selling drugs, that's unforgivable."
"Taking a man's life away from him is okay, though."
"You won't be executed, you know that. Even though you deserve it and the law allows it, we won't kill you.
You already have." That one look at Gaetano's face was all that Jane had needed. She knew instantly that he was guilty. No amount of evidence, no witnesses, no judge or jury could convince her otherwise. Gaetano had murdered Jeff Robertson, or caused his murder. It was all the same as far as she was concerned. The accident report came in a few days afterward. Jeff had been flying his own plane from Houston to Dallas, something he did almost every week. According to the coroner, he suffered a massive heart attack. He must have lost control of the plane, and it crashed, killing him. What was left of the body had been cremated, as specified in the old man's will. No chance to go back and check for poison or the kind of drug that could trigger a heart attack. As far as the world was concerned, the 88-year-old man had died of natural causes. The global energy industry mourned his passing with impressive pomp,